So this morning we're gonna talk about another parable, and this one is we're actually gonna look at two parables that are connected and parallel each other. And there's not, in some ways, there's not a lot to unpack. In other ways, there's a tremendous amount to unpack, but I feel like it's important that this is probably one of those lessons where we have a little bit more interaction. And that's not because I'm underprepared, I promise. It's because as I went through this, one of the things you have to be wary of as a teacher is creating problems that people don't have, okay? So, for example, I don't have a really good example. Let me try to explain that a little bit. I'll give you one example. So when I was in seminary, I was taking a class from a professor in OT, Old Testament, and he came to a passage that was very commonly interpreted and taught in a particular way. And he said, now, there's a good reason to think that this is a completely wrong interpretation and understanding of this passage. He said, but if you go into your church and you simply announce that, you're going to upset people and you've created a problem that they don't have. And so it's not that you're trying to avoid things, but there are times where you kind of want to uncover it yourself. You kind of want to discover it yourself. And there are things that I have found in these parables that are sort of interesting and intriguing for me, and it may not be where anyone else is, and it may not be all that helpful for you either. So a little vague on that, I realize, but just bear with me that I'm going to try as best I can to give us some sort of framework for unpacking the parables. And then I'm going to ask a lot of questions and we'll kind of see where they go. And if they end up going in some of the directions, great. And if they don't, that's okay. I'm going to kind of let you all, in a sense, lead where a lot of the conversation goes. So if you have your Bibles, we're going to look at Matthew 13. We're talking about parables. I ran across this week in DTS Magazine. This guy, Jed Ostoic, I don't know how to say his last name, but he's writing for them. And this is his lament, if you will, of how we often think about God and why this doesn't work very well. He says, we reduce God to a list of character traits rattled off at the nearest hint of a Sunday school question. And then we flip on the TV to watch a rerun of Friends. And his point is that in the midst of his whole conversation is that stories are actually more impactful, they're more influential, they're more life-changing than facts, raw data. That it's one thing to memorize a list of character traits of God, but then if I then flip on a rerun of Friends, that actually will influence more the way that I see the world, the way that I think, because stories are three-dimensional. There's a depth to them. There's language that can't be articulated within stories that impacts us. And so the question that he's sort of raising is, which do you think is more life-shaping? Is it by memorizing a bunch of facts, or is it by being immersed in story? And because of that, I think it's helpful to remember that Scripture is story. I mean, from the beginning to the end, this is one grand story, this is one narrative. And what we're doing looking at parables is looking at some smaller stories, all with the same idea, the same principle, and that is that stories cause us to lean in. We are people with stories. If I talk to you and try to get to know you over coffee, I want to know your story. I'm not just asking facts about you. The way that you share those facts is in the context of story. That's how I get to know you in a way that if I simply read, a list of facts about you, I wouldn't get there. And so that's why we continue to talk about stories, and that's why I've personally really enjoyed getting into parables. Parables, as you recall, they're not intended to be always perfectly clear. They're not always simple, but they cause us to lean in. They force us to consider more deeply what Jesus has to say to us. And that's why if you look at a parable, even the two that we're going to look at this morning, that in some sense are fairly straightforward, you can still find a very large variety of interpretations and applications, and many of which I think are valid. It's not to say that there's one way even of interpreting or applying a parable. There may be multiple ways. What we want to try to do is understand probably, I would argue, the the strongest thrust of the parable, what it's really trying to get at. But again, that doesn't mean that there aren't other applications that should be included. So one of the questions that I, before we get to it, is just when we think about story, then what does that say about how we teach our kids? When we talk about God to our kids, how do we do that? Again, are we inviting them into a story? Are we simply giving them information about God? Or in a story, are we inviting them into, I think, a relationship with God, actually knowing who God is? We just had a camp in the city here, and it was awesome with seeing all these counselors, and they're teaching our kids so much, and it was just unbelievable chaos and fun, and it was crazy. I had more than one person stop me in the hall and say, "Don't you wish it was like this every day at church?" Tommy's like, "No, I have no desire for that at all." It's because you were way too busy. That's why. But there was something. It was really exciting. We had a great time watching these kids have fun. But one of the things that Pine Cove does really well, and I appreciate, is that they both encourage the kids to memorize scripture. So there was something to memorize. In that sense, there was information that they were memorizing, but they also always embedded it in story. And so they went through stories taking place on a road. And so every day it had to do with a road, the road to Damascus, the road that Jesus was on speaking to the disciples. But it was always in the context of story that every day they are reinforcing the gospel. Every day they're saying, this is who Jesus is. This is how he loves you. This is what it means to follow him, but always in the context of story. And I think that's really powerful. Great, great ministry. All right, so Matthew 13. Let's look at a couple of these parables. So there's a whole bunch of different parables in Matthew 13. We're just going to look at a couple of them. They're kind of right towards the end. We actually already looked at the parable of the sower, although we looked at it in Luke. And we didn't look at the parable of the weeds. We might get to the mustard seed eventually, but we're going to skip all the way down to verses 44 through 46. So just three verses, the parables of the hidden treasure and the pearl. So verse 44, the kingdom of heaven is like treasure hidden in a field. When a man found it, he hid it again. And then in his joy went and sold all he had and bought that field. Again, the kingdom of heaven is like a merchant looking for fine pearls. And when he found one of great value, he went away and sold everything he had and bought it. I feel like those are so short, we should just read them again, don't you think? Let's just read them again. So verse 44, the kingdom of heaven is like treasure hidden in a field. And when a man found it, he hid it again. And then in his joy, went and sold all he had and bought that field. Again, the kingdom of heaven is like a merchant looking for fine pearls. And when he found one of great value, he went away and sold everything he had and bought it. So in general, we have two parables that hopefully you see are very, very similar. There's a lot of common themes within the two, a lot of common details even within the two, common pattern of what happens. But there's definitely some differences between the two that I'd like to bring out in just a moment. But let's start with this. So Jesus is speaking of the kingdom of heaven. So what is that? The kingdom of heaven. So you're reading this with one of your kids, okay? And you're sitting down, and depending on the age of your kid, maybe they're well past this, they can answer this. Hopefully they're in the high school or middle school, and they know what Jesus is talking about here. But maybe for like one of my kids who's six, you know, kingdom of heaven, or even my eight-year-old, what does that mean? How would you explain that? Not everybody all at once. Slow down. Kingdom of heaven.
God's economy.
God's economy, okay. You have to explain that a little bit. So God's trading and
his values, the world's values.
Okay.
His currency, not our currency.
Okay.
His values, not our values, yeah.
Okay. All right. So it has to do with
It could be parallel.
Could be parallel to
it could be going on right now, doesn't have to happen after we die.
Okay. All right. Okay, so values, all right. Anybody else? An inheritance?
Yeah,
I think there's a dynamic of values that are reflected in the kingdom, and then there's the inheritance, which is what is ours through Christ. Okay.
Of course, maybe for a child it would be something as simple as a place where God sets all the rules.
Okay, there you go. So that has to do with the values, but it's where God sets all the rules. Okay.
Where our King rules.
Where our King rules. Okay, Kingdom of Heaven. There you go. Say it one more time.
I would say it's God setting all of the rules and us choosing that we're going to live that life of obedience.
Okay. So far you guys are mostly describing, see if I can do this. You're mostly describing kind of what the kingdom is in its, almost like what it's like to be in the kingdom. Like these are the values in the kingdom, the king and his values, where he's in charge, where he's setting the rules. Where is this kingdom of heaven? I mean, it doesn't seem like your kids might ask that question. It's just like, what are we talking about? So this kingdom, where is it? Where do we find this kingdom?
Somewhere in the universe, or the universe?
The universe, okay.
Wherever we are.
Okay, wherever we are. Is it now or is it later? Yes. Okay. All right. So we're okay.
Candy. Now later.
There's a candy that's yes. Now and later. I don't know that. Okay. No, I have no idea what that is.
Is it an old candy?
I don't know. Now Chelsea's nodding. So
now and later's.
I don't like candy. I don't know. Maybe I just. There we go. All right. Okay. So the kingdom of heaven. So let's think about this. If you're trying to explain this, now I'm just having fun with this. All right, so if you're trying to explain this to your kids, all right, heck, try to explain this to somebody who's never heard of this before. I mean, what you guys just described, I just think you're a crazy person, right? So what do we do with that? How do you begin to explain this? When he's talking about the kingdom of heaven, let's assume that he's speaking. Seems like in the context he's speaking to his followers. If you go up here, he left the crowd in verse 36. He left the crowd and went into the house. His disciples came and said, explain to us the parables of the weeds in the field. Talking about the prior parable. But there's no real change in context. In verse 44, it seems like in the context he's still speaking to them. We also know that Matthew is pulling different teachings together as he's putting his gospel together. So we don't know that this chronologically happened in the way that it's being laid out. But you do find at the end of this passage too, in verse 51, he turns to them and says, have you understood all these things? So it seems like he's in the context of speaking to the disciples about these parables. Do you understand? Okay, so he's speaking to his followers. What do they think he's talking about, the kingdom of heaven?
They think he's talking about the future.
Okay. All right, so now we're dealing with the future, okay, in their mind.
Were they also thinking about overthrowing the Romans and kind of the Barabbas stuff and coming in and conquering?
Yeah, okay, so they have a very concrete understanding of the kingdom, probably. There's some idea in their minds of the kingdom of Israel that is going to become, and because they are God's chosen people, that would then be the kingdom of God or the kingdom of heaven. Okay, so they have a very concrete, but ours doesn't sound as concrete as you're describing it to me. Okay, what are we going to do with this, guys? Kingdom of heaven, okay, all right. Are you going to, okay, when you say now and later, is there a difference between what it looks like now and later, this kingdom? Okay, how is it different, now versus later?
Now is a very, very, very limited
okay.
Representation of what it will be like when he comes back and makes it all happy.
Okay. So it's now, but it's a very dim picture. or very, it's like a, just a taste of it. Okay?
It now requires faith, and the later will not require the same amount of faith.
Okay. So oftentimes the language that is used as theologians try to unpack this idea of kingdom has to do with inaugurated versus fully realized. So they speak of a kingdom that has been inaugurated, as in the sense that it has begun in some sense. Okay, so Jesus embodies the kingdom. This is how he is the king of the kingdom. His life expresses the values of the kingdom, God's economy, and it reflects the rules of the kingdom. Okay, what life should be and how life should be lived in the kingdom is wrapped up in the life of Christ. And in that sense, there's the kingdom has come. This is why he is announcing this throughout the Gospels. The kingdom has come. Where? Him. That guy. Okay. And then we see, so then what happens, right? Jesus dies, he comes back to life, and then what happens? He does something.
He goes away.
He goes away. Where does he go? To heaven. What's that?
Sits
at the right hand of God. And what does he say at the end of Matthew? What does... I'll never leave you, but in that same passage, what does he say? Yeah, but why? He says, therefore, that go make disciples. What's before the therefore? Why is the therefore? What is that? You know? All power and authority has been given to him. Okay, so we think of this as being inaugurated in the sense that the kingdom has come in Christ. He sits at the right hand of the Father. But we also recognize the kingdom hasn't fully arrived. The kingdom has yet to be fully realized. And when is that going to happen? Yeah, nobody knows, but there's kind of a marker. Yeah, when he returns, and even then, okay, which return are we talking about? So not everyone's theology agrees with this, okay? So I'm assuming here. So at Grace Bible Church, we have a dispensational view of redemptive history. So those are big words. Dispensational has to do with the framework of how God interacts with his creation, with how he interacts with people, how he bestows his blessing. So dispensations change. They look different in how God interacts with us. Not different in how we are saved, but different in how God is orchestrating his blessing on the world. And within that, so we believe that there's multiple dispensations, and that in some sense leads us to a reading where there's a millennial kingdom when Christ first comes back. And so Christ returns, that's after the rapture, but anyway, so we get to the millennial kingdom, and even that one isn't the fully realized kingdom. I think it was Dr. Pentecost said that that's like the front porch to eternity. So you have the millennial kingdom, and then you have the eternal kingdom. Now, that eternal kingdom, when people talk about heaven, that's what they're talking about, okay? So how many of your kids have an idea of heaven? Have they ever heard the term heaven? Yeah, okay. When they think heaven, what are they thinking about?
Like cartoons and clouds and harps.
Yeah, there's some of that going on, right? Right? Okay. There's kind of an ethereal, we're floating around. We have, like you said, harps and this kind of thing. There's no bodies. Right, we're not actually physical, we're just sort of spiritual. So that heaven is actually not the eternal kingdom heaven. That heaven is what we might call paradise. But when they think heaven, there's something else they're thinking about with heaven, isn't there? Like when they think heaven, they're not just thinking what it will be like. They're not just thinking, okay, I'm floating on a cloud and there's halos and stuff like that. What else do we mean by heaven? Or what else might they be thinking
streets
when they think
of
heaven? Streets of gold. Yeah, yeah, more. How does it feel? It's where God lives, but how does it feel? Is it good or is it bad?
No tears.
No tears. It's where God is. Is it nice? Yeah, is it good? Is it kind of like where everything you've ever dreamed of comes true?
That's what the brochure says.
It's what the brochure says, right? Okay, so when people think heaven, and they're going, yeah, heaven, that's where everything comes true. Like every dream, every wish, everything that could possibly be good, all of that, what they're thinking of, is in that sense, that's the eternal kingdom. Everything that God has promised, everything that we look forward to, everything that our hearts long for, everything that this world only gives us tastes of and is incomplete, everything that we have, you know, that keeps us up in the middle of the night knowing we're longing for something more, that is the eternal kingdom. Okay. Where was I going with all this? Anyway, okay. So with the kingdom of heaven then, in some sense, if I'm teaching this to my kids, what I want them to understand is that the kingdom of heaven is what you're longing for. It's what you're, it's the deepest desire of your heart is to be where God is, but it's to be where there's no more tears, no more sorrow, no more sickness, no more pain, and so on. This is what all of our hearts are longing for, this, whether they realize it or not. And then as they get older, okay, I'm going to unpack this a little bit more, okay? We're going to unpack the now and the later, and we're going to unpack the millennial kingdom versus the eternal kingdom, and we're going to unpack heaven as paradise versus heaven the way we actually understand it as the eternal kingdom. But for right now, man, if I'm teaching this to my kids, I just want them to think kingdom of heaven. That's the place. That's where your hope is. That's what you're longing for. That's where God is. That's where God makes all the rules, but not in the sense that he's making all the rules to make you follow them, but in the sense that everything is the way it should be. It's perfect, right? Okay. So what I hope maybe is helpful is that, yes, we can unpack the kingdom of heaven and we can write books about it. But you can also understand what's at the heart of it. And that you can communicate to a 3-year-old. That you can communicate to a 6-year-old, an 8-year-old, or a 13-year-old, or a 15-year-old, or wherever they are. That communicates to me. I can unpack it, and that's good. I need to do that. That's helpful. There's important stuff to unpack there. But where it resonates with my heart is in the sense that this is what my heart is longing for. The parable doesn't make sense if I don't have that. Because otherwise, why in the world does he care that he found the treasure? Okay, so the kingdom of heaven. Oh, yeah, the kingdom of heaven. That's what I'm longing for. That's what they were longing for. They were the disciples, right? The followers, but they were longing for the wrong. They didn't have the right picture. The kingdom of heaven. Man, I should read that and I should go, oh, yeah, you're right. Tell me more about this kingdom. That's what I want. That's what I want. Oh, let me tell you what it's like. It's like a treasure hidden in a field. Okay, so it's there, but it's hidden. It's there, but in some sense, you can't see it. It's hidden. But when a man found it, he hid it again. Remember, parables don't always add up exactly the way that we want. But just hold on. And then in his joy went and sold all he had and bought that field. Again, the kingdom of heaven. Oh, yeah. I want that. I want that kingdom. I want that place where my heart comes alive. It's like a merchant looking for fine pearls. And when he found one of great value, he went away and sold everything he had and bought it. Okay, so a couple of questions. What do you find in common between these two parables? A couple of observations. What's in common between these two?
It's worth, each time it's worth everything.
Yeah. Yeah, okay.
It says everything.
It's worth everything.
Yeah.
Okay, so it's of immeasurable value. Okay. What do they do? What do they do when they find them?
They immediately act and sell.
Okay. Okay, this is interesting. In neither case do they get it immediately. In both cases, what do they do?
They
The first one does sound that way. Yeah. Yeah. So we're gonna hide it. Maybe not. I don't think it's about evangelism. That's okay. But what do they do? What do they do?
They leave.
They leave. And where do they go?
They'll get their property possessions and stuff.
Yeah. So in both cases, they don't get it immediately. That's interesting. There's a delay here. They find it, they love it, they value it, they treasure it, they want it, and then they have to go away. They have to leave it. And then what do? That when they leave, they
sell
everything. So they reorder their priorities.
Yeah, there's a works-based kind of element to this.
Whoa.
Yeah, which is
okay. We'll get to that in a second. That's mm-hmm. Okay. So they reorder their lives. They reprioritize their lives. They sell everything. Okay.
They were searching.
One of them was. Maybe. We don't know with the first one. I mean, it's possible that he was working the field.
He still found it. He still knew he was looking. He recognized it when he found
it. Yeah, he recognized it when he was sounded. It's possible that there's a distinction between the two. I don't know if it's how much to make of it. It's possible that in agrarian society, he's working the field and stumbles across this treasure. Oh my goodness, this is amazing. And he certainly recognizes its value when he sees it. But in the second case, he's clearly looking. I mean, he's searching for it, although there's still a sense in like he's amazed at the value of this one. It's like, oh my goodness. Pearls, by the way, back then were what diamonds might be for us now. Okay, so we might see a number of diamonds. You know, you're kind of looking for diamonds. Those are nice. And then you find, if I knew anything about diamonds, like that diamond. And that's what it's describing here. Okay, so we have some parallels here. There's a something else that's in the first story that's not in the second, but I think might be implicit here, and that has to do with joy. So he finds the treasure, and then this is really important. He says, in his joy, he went and sold all he had and bought that field. And I think, and maybe not, but it seems like there's an excitement with the merchant as well. It doesn't seem like he's doing this out of duty or obligation, like he owes this to someone, but it's like he sees the value of this pearl and he goes and excitedly sells everything he has to get it. So that's pretty important. And especially when we think about, so John immediately has to like open the can of worms and start talking about works here. That seems like an important part of that conversation, is that he does it out of joy.
Is it joy or is it an excitement? You know, there's a thrill of, hey, if I, you know, play my cards right, I can win this over, even albeit dishonestly.
Yeah. Yeah, and then there's that whole side of it. Yeah, yeah. I don't know. Maybe it's both. Maybe it's joy in the sense of, oh my goodness, I found this treasure, and I'm so excited to possess it.
It's one thing to the merchant sees something
mm-hmm.
and can legally buy it.
Uh-huh.
Whereas the other is thinking, I have to hide this so that I can accomplish that. So it's not the same level of joy in each case.
Or the same level of joy.
Maybe it's joy with something else, a thrill of not getting caught or
oh, okay.
Is. But there's something else that's there
okay.
that is hidden within that joy.
Okay, yeah,
does
Christine.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I'd be pretty joyful about that too. Yeah, yeah. So Doug, to your point, there's a lot of debate and discussion over what was legal in that culture in terms of like if you were working a field, if it belongs to someone else, if you find it, and there's a lot of it's not as clear as we might find it today. So we see it and go, clearly this guy's being dishonest and he's taking this. It's possible that. That wasn't the practice of the time. But even if it was, not sure how much we should read into that or not. But it's a good question. It's a good point. See, this is where these parables can get a little bit dicey, right?
Texas example would be if somebody thinks there's oil underneath the land, and you go buy the land for crops, but you actually go put a rig out there and you get the treasure that's underneath the land.
There you go. Would that be illegal?
No.
No. Okay.
There's a similar issue with the merchant. The merchant doesn't tell the seller how valuable the pearl is.
Correct. Yeah, he doesn't turn around and say, by the way, did you know that the one that you have is actually worth like way more than, you know.
Yeah. If you see a Picasso in a garage sale, you're not going to.
Yeah, you don't announce it.
You pay the dollar for the Picasso.
Yeah. There's actually a story I was just reading about a guy, because I was looking up different illustrations that have to do with this, and there was a guy who actually was looking at some very inexpensive gems at like a side of the road, you know, place in Missouri or something. And they've got these jars full of these not very valuable gems. You can get each one for like $5 or whatever. And there was one, no, sorry, they were $15. That's what it was. And his two sons had $5 each. And he didn't have any money on him. And it was only cash. And he looks in there and there's this really ugly one, like hideously ugly one. And he was like, can I get that one for $10? And the guy was like, sure, that one's ugly. Just, you know, so he took the five from both of his sons and takes it. Well, he was a gem collector himself and recognized that inside that ugliness was like the world's largest gem of some kind that was worth like $2.5 million uncut and $10 million cut. And yeah, he didn't mention it to the guy who was selling them for five, you know, for $15. So yeah, whatever you make of that in terms of ethically how you should handle that, I don't know. That's a tough one.
Jesus telling us to be shrewd as
a servant. Yeah, possibly. I don't know. Okay, so we've got some element of joy here, and there's some element of excitement. They see something and it has great wealth, and then they respond to it. Okay. Let's see here. There's another difference here. Let's see what kind of time we have. I'll just mention this one real quickly. One is with the treasure in the field. There seems to be an implication that, it seems like if you found a treasure, the point of the treasure is, as Christine said, to do what? To make your life easy, right? You find a treasure, and then what do you do with the treasure? You spend it, or you sell it, or you trade it, and you get everything you want, and you never have to work, and you create capital for yourself and investments and so on, okay? The pearl's different. I mean, he just sold everything he had to get the pearl. What's he going to do? Does he sell the pearl?
He's going to sit and stare at it.
Yeah, I think so.
I think he's going to eat it for dinner.
He's going to eat it.
He sold everything he has to sell.
I think he has to, but there's kind of a sense in which he just wants the pearl. You know? This is the one he's been looking for. This is the one he's looking for. This is what he wants. I don't know. I kind of wonder. I know, but it's a parable. It's a parable. It's a parable.
What he had equaled the actual value of that pearl. It could have been less.
It could have been. Maybe he sold everything he had to get.
Who knows what he had?
Yeah, I mean, maybe he only had $10, and that was all he had to get this pearl that actually was worth $10 million, and so he lives off that. So, yeah, we don't know. I wonder, though, like, There's a sense, though, in which, as we think about the kingdom of heaven, that it is both something that is for us, that will make our lives wonderful and amazing, and we'll never have to work again. Understand how I mean that. That sort of like, oh, I'm finally rich and wealthy beyond my wildest dreams, but also in that the kingdom has value in and of itself. And those seem to be inseparable. That if I long for the kingdom, for what it can get me, I'll never find it. But if I long for the kingdom for what it is, I will have joy beyond my wildest imagination. Does that make sense? And again, I may be reading too much into the parables at this point, but that was kind of how I put those two things together. Okay, so what is the point of this parable? We've got just a few minutes, so let's kind of wrap it up here. Hopefully this was somewhat interesting. What's the point?
read like way too far into it, you know, and like, what did he own before and this and that. But it's like, you know, we have to remember it's not actually talking about physical or physical treasure. It's talking about the kingdom of heaven.
Right.
It's these men who discover something amazing, which is the kingdom of heaven. So they ditch everything that they've ever known. So that's, you know, to me, this is how much I am a theologian. So, forgive me, I'm totally off.
You're fine. You're fine.
But, like, they leave everything behind, which is, like, when Jesus tells his disciples, like, you know, you leave your family behind, you leave everything behind, and you follow me, you know?
Yeah.
And so it's like they go, leave everything behind, leave the world behind, and they pursue this, in this case, treasure or pearl, which is the kingdom of heaven. So it's like they pursue Jesus, essentially, or they pursue, you know, what is to come. So, I mean, I feel like it's kind of like that, and it doesn't have anything to do with, I mean, to me, it seems like it doesn't have anything to do with, like, what are they going for, or, you know, are they going to sell it, or anything like that, which I think sometimes you could say, like, well, selling something like that could be, like, evangelism, but I think it goes without saying that Jesus is a mission.
Yeah.
Like, whether they sell it or not.
Yeah.
But in this case, I think it's just that they've discovered what the kingdom is, and they, so they leave everything behind, and they pursue that because it's Jesus.
Mm-hmm. Steve.
Along with that, it's a reorienting of values, maybe.
Yeah.
Because before he had talked about in the tares, he said the field is the world, the good seed are the sons of the kingdom, the tares are the sons of the evil one. He's delineating the good and the bad, and it's this reorienting of an understanding of what's really worthwhile.
Yeah.
And until we understand the worthwhile, the value of the kingdom, it's not worth selling anything.
Mm-hmm.
But once you do, it's, you know, worth selling everything.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. Yeah, Doug.
So behind both parables, regardless of how you interpret anything, it's the investment of it, right? The comparison is God's kingdom or kingdom of heaven. So you find heaven, it's everything to you. You invest what you can.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's the point, right?
Yeah.
And it's worth whatever the cost.
Yeah. And I think this is why asking the question of whether or not, okay, the temptation is, and I appreciate John bringing this up for us way at the beginning, is to read something like this and begin to ask questions of, does this have to do with salvation by grace or salvation by works and so on? I think that's an unhelpful framework for these parables. What you guys have just described, I think, is really helpful and accurate, which is the conversation has to do with how do you value the kingdom? How high a value do you place on it? Not that you work for it, but that it necessitates a response. So if I value the kingdom, then I will respond in order to receive it or to find it or to get it or to gain it or whatever. But it's not in the sense of like I'm working to earn it per se. I think of this in the same way as I think about this is true of relationships, okay? So my wife Carrie, when I saw her and realized that she was the most beautiful person in the world to me, that necessitated a response on my part, but I did not earn her love. We didn't enter into a relational transaction where I said, okay, Carrie, if I will do all of these things to win your love, if I check all those boxes, then you will agree to marry me, right? No, that had nothing to do with it. I was compelled. There was nothing that I could do. I was helpless in that sense. I was in love with her, therefore I will respond in this way to try to win her heart so that she would say yes, okay? And I think that when I think about these parables, what he's describing here is this overwhelming sense of joy, of love, of value for that treasure or that pearl that I have no choice but to respond to. To me, it's less a, well, what will you do to get the kingdom? It's more of a, do you love Jesus? What Rachel was saying, do you value the kingdom? And if so, then this is how you're going to respond. This is how you will, reorder your life. If you don't, then you won't. It's that simple. If you found the treasure and thought, that looks like junk to me, then you wouldn't go and reorder your life. If you saw the pearl and didn't realize its value, then you wouldn't go and liquidate all your assets to purchase it. It's because you see the value of it, you believe the value of it, you know the value of it, you love it, that you go and do those things. And I think there's one of the things with parables, can I just make a statement? They don't give us the whole picture, okay? And so a lot of times what we try to do is read our full theological framework into a parable. And maybe what we need to do is just say, maybe he's just giving us one piece of it. And in this piece, it's just a question of, how well do you love me? Do you love me? Do you love the kingdom? Are you looking forward to the kingdom? If you do, then this follows. If you don't, then you won't. Something, and then he sort of leaves it. Chew on that for a while. And I think that's, we're uncomfortable with that, right? We can be uncomfortable with that. Okay, now I'm supposed to chew on it. No, solve it for us, Jesus. Well, Jesus doesn't always like to do that. And that's okay. I think there's a good space here. I think what I will say, though, is if you're going, well, I'm not sure how much I love the kingdom, or if I'm not sure if I'm comfortable stopping in that place, all of Scripture should point back to Christ. And so if you need a landing place, here it is. That Jesus is the guy in the field who finds the treasure that is you. And he goes and he sells everything that he has and gives up heaven to die for you. He is the merchant who finds the pearl that is us, the church, his people. And he goes and he sells everything, gives up his very life in order to get that pearl. And if you need to land anywhere, well, that's a pretty good place to land.